This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, Tim Page, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic who found out in middle age that he had the autistic disorder Asperger's syndrome. That diagnosis helped explain the lifelong unease he had experienced and why his pervasive childhood memory was an excruciating awareness of his own strangeness. Page's memoir, called Parallel Play, Life as an Outsider, is now out in paperback. It's about how his condition affected his life and his relationship with music. Page won the Pulitzer in 1997 for his work as chief classical music critic at the Washington Post. That was 3 years before his diagnosis. Before joining the Post, he was a music critic at the New York Times and at Newsday. He's now a professor of journalism and music at the University of Southern California. Tim Page spoke with Terry Gross in 2009.
Tim Page, welcome to Fresh Air. What did they tell you when they gave you the diagnosis of Asperger's? What did they tell you that meant?
Well, I'm now allowed by my middle son to tell the circumstances where I was diagnosed. We had taken my son Robbie in because he was having some social difficulties. And that's when he was diagnosed, and he has just given me permission to talk about this because he's 19. That was when I was diagnosed. I'd never heard of it. It turns out it's terribly hereditary. It turns out that a good amount of adults are actually diagnosed when their children are diagnosed. And my own guess is that my father had it too. So the doctor just gave a long and thoughtful explanation of the condition and then diagnosed my son and then said, you have it too. And so I went out and I went to see my own doctor and read up on it, and I was pretty sure that I had it as well.
What year and how old were you when you were diagnosed with Asperger's?
I was 45 years old, and it was in the fall of 2000. So it was either, I believe I was then still 45, but I turned 46 that fall. I'll give you a good description from David Mamet, who wrote in his book Bambi versus Godzilla, about Asperger's syndrome. And he wrote that it's not impossible that it helped make the movies. The symptoms of this developmental disorder include early precocity, a great ability to maintain masses of information, a lack of ability to mix with groups in age-appropriate ways, ignorance of or indifference to social norms, high intelligence and difficulty with transition, married to a preternatural ability to concentrate on the minutiae of the task at hand. I had all of that. I continue to have all of that. I can remember all sorts of trivia, but I don't notice what somebody has on. I neglect my, my shirt tails and I guess it's sort of like your absent-minded professor times five, if that makes any sense. And it's somewhere, at least most experts agree, it's somewhere along the autistic spectrum, which means somewhere in the 0 to 100 of, zero having no autistic traits and 100 being completely isolated. I'm somewhere in the middle.
Usually when you get a diagnosis, the goal is to get some kind of medication or therapy to help fix it. With what you have, which is, Asperger's, is there something you're trying to fix, or is the diagnosis just helping you define certain behavior patterns and help you figure out who you are and how to make the most of who you are?
I would say that the diagnosis helped me realize that there were certain things that were part of my nature and that were pretty much fixed, that were not very changeable, much as I would like them to be changeable. And it helped me avoid things, I would say, for the most part. But I was already on all sorts of palliative things for people with Asperger's. I mean, I've had my own little prescription for Valium since I was 15, and I've been on antidepressants, and I've been on, I meditate. I do everything I can to sort of get through a day. And most days I get through pretty well. And I know when I need to just escape and get rid of whatever overstimulation I'm feeling and sort of calm myself. And that's the big struggle for me during the day, and, before the one at night, which is getting to sleep one way or another. I'd like to think that there's a utopia someplace where kids who are 2 and 3 It's explained to them gently what they have, and they're given some therapy that helps them to deal with parents, teachers, peers. And maybe the depression and the anxiety will go away. But certainly depression and anxiety were concomitant states that I've had since I came to consciousness.
You write, from early childhood, my memory was so acute and my wit so bleak that I was described as a genius. I wrapped myself in this mantle as poetic justification for behavior that might otherwise have been judged unhinged. Like what? What kind of license did your eccentricities give you?
Well, I don't think they really gave me a whole lot of license, but the school kind of had to put up with me, and it was a small town, so they promoted me to the next grade. I was either asleep looking out windows when the teacher was talking about something that I wasn't interested in, or I was acting out and making faces and, you know, answering with ridiculous questions or just basically showing my contempt for the class all through my childhood. And I couldn't get this out of my system. I was aggressive and I'd push people out on the playground. I mean, I wasn't really a bully because I was inept as an athlete. I got D's and F's and an occasional C. I was thrilled when I got a B. It was really one of those things where I simply couldn't concentrate except on the stuff that I could concentrate on very well. And back then, the idea that somebody could be articulate and could actually still have an autistic disorder, they didn't compute. The idea of somebody who was autistic was somebody who rarely spoke and maybe banged his head. And I was sort of doing my own version of head banging, although it was not quite in the same way. The thing that was really nice was some teachers, recognizing that I was overstimulated, would let me go to the nurse's office where I'd calm myself down. And the nicest teachers would actually let me stay in at recess, where I'd always get in trouble and get myself punched out or something. And I'd just stay in and I'd read through the World Book Encyclopedia and I basically memorized it. It was a strange brain, you know.
Looking back, how do you think Asperger syndrome affected your interest in music and how you listened to music when you were coming of age?
I have this theory that Asperger's syndrome has been hugely important for me with music because it was the first world that made any sense to me. I didn't really understand what was going on around me. I didn't understand what people really wanted me to do, what kind of expressions. I was a very lost little kid, but my mom had this record player, and she was kind enough to let me ruin her record collection by just playing records over and over and over again. And I'd memorize what all the music was. And it allowed me passage into a world where everything made sense and where I felt this profound sense of being at home in the world. And it was always very easy for me to talk about music. I mean, I couldn't identify chords or anything technical, but I could make at least enough sense out of it for me that it showed me that there was kind of another dimension out there, and I wanted to be in that dimension as much as I could because the real world didn't make any sense to me.
You write in your book that when you first heard Philip Glass and his pattern minimalist music, that you felt, I forget the words you exactly used, but you felt like you were listening to the inside of your very essence, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Describe what you felt when you first heard minimalist music.
Well, I'd heard a little bit of it beforehand because there were a couple of records that came out in the late 60s, Terry Riley and Steve Reich did some fairly early recordings. So I knew a little bit about it. But the 1976 was a huge year for me because there was the world premiere of Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. And then later in the year, the U.S. premiere of Einstein on the Beach by Philip Glass and Robert Wilson. And especially with Music for 18 Musicians, it had me so incredibly excited by all that was going on in the music that I went up to my room and I started writing what I consider my first more or less mature criticism.
We queued up, because you mentioned it in your book, we queued up Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. I want to play the first minute of it.
Okay.
And then I want you to talk about it and tell us, if you remember, what you wrote about it, because you say the first real serious piece of music criticism that you wrote was about this piece after you heard it. So let's give it a shot for a minute, and then we'll talk. The opening of Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. And
so wonderful.
Isn't it wonderful? Yeah, I know. So, Tim Page, what does that music do for you when you hear it?
Well, I thought I'd read you a little bit of what I wrote that night.
Oh, terrific.
In April of 1976, as a 21-year-old, having absolutely no idea that anybody would ever publish me. But I spent the whole night trying to describe that music in words. And I said, imagine concentrating on a challenging modern painting that becomes just a little bit different every time you shift your attention from one detail to another. Or trying to impose a frame on a running river, making it a finite, enclosed work of art, yet leaving its kinetic quality unsullied, leaving it flowing freely on all sides. And then I said, it has been done. Steve Reich has framed the river. And I still have that same sort of feeling for this music. I guess I would add now that it's music that's not so much about going places and arriving somewhere and big crises and climaxes as it is about the actual journey rather than arrival or leaving from someplace. You're just fascinated by what's going on at the moment, just surrendering yourself to speed and jostling and, you know, gorgeous sensations that that overwhelm you. And I love the sort of patterning of it all.
And, you know, the patterning is very repetition, but at the same time, it's constantly shifting in perceptible and almost imperceptible ways. Does that speak to you?
Very, very much. And that really is what I think my insides feel like. But it calls to mind this kind of ecstatic quality, which I have occasionally felt. One of my very few visual, ecstasies is watching clouds change slowly over the course of an afternoon. I love process. I love patterns. I love seeing things just change slightly, but also still catching you up in the whole process. And that's something that I remember from being very, very young. And I love the fact that there are some wonderful musicians who are exploring that now.
As a teenager, you tried LSD several times, and you say the trips were nightmarish. And
yep.
I'm wondering if you think your symptoms were magnified by the LSD and if that contributed to the bad trips.
Anything in the world that makes me more self-conscious is the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And LSD and marijuana, both of which I tried and tried and tried to like in my mid-teens, college campus and a lot of my friends doing them, were really sort of nightmarish for me. I had a great time on marijuana for a while, but it started to induce panic attacks, which continued. And I think they may have had something to do with the LSD that I took, all of this stuff I did before I ever, you know, drank wine civilly. It was so much easier in those days, especially on a college campus, to find drugs than it was to, you know, split a six-pack of beer. I think probably my anxiety level was not going to be helped by these, you know, very much internalizing drugs. And with LSD in one case, I just took such a huge dose that I just lost myself entirely. And it's, you know, I thought that taking LSD would be like swallowing a movie and I'd just be watching it on a screen and I'd see some nice things and some frightening things. But what happens, of course, is that your whole brain is so screwed up and you're so lost by it that all that it did for me was just made me want to scream and run and escape from all this terror that was in my system, which I think is there pretty much to begin with. But certainly those kind of drugs make it much, much worse. And it's, you know, they've been something that I've avoided, you know, very strongly for, you know, 35 years.
I want to bring up something that I don't think you write about in the book. And this, this had a big impact on you professionally. And I think it's possible it relates to what we were talking about in terms of inappropriate behavior that you've...
I think I know where you're going.
You know where I'm driving. A couple of years ago when you were a music critic at the Washington Post, you wrote a very inappropriate email to one of Marion Barry's aides. And you were on their like email list for their press releases and stuff. And you wanted to get off of it. And do you mind if I just quote the line that you wrote?
I don't love it, but I don't mind.
Okay. You demanded to be taken off the email list and wrote, "Must we hear about it every time this crack addict attempts to rehabilitate himself with some new and typically half-witted political grandstanding? I'd be grateful if you would take me off your mailing list. I cannot think of anything the useless Marion Barry could do that would interest me in the slightest, up to and including overdose." So you apologized for that. After the fact.
I felt terrible that I'd done it, but there was a story behind that. I had asked to be taken off the email list before, and the his flack had actually called me all sorts of four-letter words and said things about my mother and, you know, I mean, just was really impossible about it. And so this happened to come in on a very, very bad day. And I thought, well, they don't seem to take my word for it, so I'm going to zing it to them. I never expected they'd turn it into anything. But and, you know, if I were Marion Barry, I don't think I'd want everybody in the world to remember that I had been a crack addict or a crack user. But they seemed to want to turn it into something, and they seemed to want to blame the Washington Post for it. And they seemed to want to make me out as a racist. And I was very crude there, but I felt that it was, you know, something which I should apologize for. And I did. And the Post agreed with me and the Post stood by me. And so, you know, he wanted to publicize it. He got his moment in the sun. And, you know, it was very embarrassing for me. I was miserable. I'd just been through a split up with somebody I love dearly, and I overreacted. I feel badly about it, but I still sometimes overreact to things.
You know, I've worn glasses since kindergarten, and you write in your book that you rarely wear your glasses now because they make you aware of too much.
Yeah, I know.
It's an interesting choice.
It's a quirk, and I should be wearing them, but I don't drive. And I see well enough to read. And I found that when I started trying to adapt to glasses, two things happened. Number one, my ability to read without glasses seems somewhat impacted. But number two, I all of a sudden felt that I was being intimate with everybody on the street. You know, I'd just look at somebody, I'd look at them looking back at me, and it began to feel very invasive and somewhat anxiety provoking. And so since I don't drive, I haven't really had to wear glasses because I can see close up front. But I guess in general, I like the fact that I kind of put the world together by sensation and sound and, you know, patterns. And I find it strangely invasive to be out there. It's one of the reasons I don't drive, too. I don't want to compete with people. And I think if I could, I'd like to be invisible.
Tim Page, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Tim Page, speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. Tim Page is a Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic and a professor of journalism and music at the University of Southern California. His memoir, called Parallel Play, Life as an Outsider, is now out in paperback. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. There's something wrong with broadcast network television, and this week makes it glaringly obvious. This is fall premiere week, when ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the CW are trying their best to impress us with their new and returning shows. Yet their thunder continues to be stolen by cable. Last Sunday, it was the premiere of HBO's Boardwalk Empire, which did so well after one showing, with critics and viewers, that it already has been renewed for season two. AMC's Mad Men continues to serve up fabulous first-run hours on Sundays. And now, beginning this weekend, a third cable network is competing for bragging rights as having the best primetime drama series on television. That's because Showtime is presenting the fifth season premiere of Dexter, one of the most inventive and exciting shows on TV. Michael C. Hall, who played the uptight gay Undertaker on HBO's 6 Feet Under, stars as Dexter Morgan, a blood-spatter forensics expert. He helps solve murders and track down serial killers as a member of the Miami Police Department. But he has a deep, dark secret. He's a serial killer himself and channels his murderous impulses by hunting and capturing other serial killers and serving secretly as judge, jury, and especially executioner. Yes, it's a twisted idea for a series. But Dexter, over its first 4 seasons, has explored those twists with breathtaking imagination. We've learned and witnessed in flashback the childhood trauma that made Dexter into the emotionless shell that he is. And, over the years, we've watched him go from faking emotions to experiencing some real ones, and even finding love. Rita, played by Julie Benz, was a battered woman with 2 young children when Dexter met her, and they found peace simply by being together. Eventually, they got married and had a baby of their own, and Dexter seemed happy. But after years of spilling blood in secret, Dexter had his unexpectedly normal life shattered in just as bloody a fashion. He had a showdown to the death with another serial murderer, called the Trinity Killer, and played all last season by guest star John Lithgow. Dexter was victorious, then returned home to find that the Trinity Killer previously had claimed his final victim, Dexter's wife, Rita. The series ended for the season. Lithgow won an Emmy for his performance. And Sunday, we finally find out what Dexter will do next, with his wife gone, his world shattered, and 3 young kids in tow. Season 5 begins exactly where Season 4 ended, at the crime scene, with Dexter cradling his baby, whom Dexter found sitting and crying in a pool of his mother's blood. Where do you go from there? Well, to some of the obvious places. Police reports, funeral preparations, conversations with co-workers and in-laws. But it's the non-obvious places that make this character and this series so daringly original. From the start, Dexter the TV series has relied on the same crucial narrative gimmick introduced in the original novels by Jeff Lindsay. We see things through Dexter's eyes and hear his thoughts, which, in the TV version, come through in a variety of ways. Sometimes he sees and talks with the ghost of his late foster father. Other times, he has vivid flashbacks. And always, he's dropping in quick bits of voiceover narration to tell us what he's really thinking, even after one of his own flashbacks. That's what happens here in a scene from Sunday's season premiere, as Dexter is recalling a phone conversation the night he first met Rita. We hear their conversation. Then, returning to the present, we hear Dexter's final thoughts as he revs up the engine on his boat and drives away. Julie Benz plays Rita. Michael C. Hall is Dexter.
I know I should hang up right now, but I just need to say it. I don't know why exactly, but you make me feel good. Like things can be different.
So do you. Make me feel that way, too.
Glad I called. felt up in the air the way things ended. You know, like we never said a proper goodbye. So.
Goodbye, Rita Bennett.
Goodbye, Dexter Morgan.
So where is Dexter driving his boat, and where does his life go from there? I'm not telling. But I will tell you that like almost every episode of Dexter, it's a surprising, sometimes jaw-dropping journey. Longtime Dexter fans have come to expect moments that have you all but screaming at your TV set in disbelief, or wondering how you'll be able to wait a week for the next installment. I've previewed this season's first three episodes, and I had to pick up my jaw twice. And at the end of episode 3, I was angry at Showtime that they hadn't sent number 4. Dexter is that good. This is Fresh Air. Nick Hornby is best known for his novel High Fidelity, about a guy who owns a record store and is obsessed with pop music. Hornby returned to the world of music obsession in his latest novel, Juliet Naked, which just came out in paperback. The new novel introduces a British couple, Duncan and Annie. Duncan is an expert on singer, songwriter, and guitarist Tucker Crowe, who suddenly gave up recording and performing decades earlier. Duncan has since become an expert on Crowe's music and runs a website devoted to every known detail of Crowe's life and work. There's big news in Duncan's world when Crowe releases a collection of demos from his most famous album. Annie posts a negative review on Duncan's site, and Crowe responds to it. Annie and Crowe meet, and a weird triangle is formed. Terry spoke with Nick Hornby last year and asked him to start with a reading.
It wasn't as if Duncan didn't have other interests. He had a specialist knowledge of 1970s American independent cinema and the novels of Nathaniel West, and he was developing a nice new line in HBO television series. He thought he might be ready to teach The Wire in the not-too-distant future. But these were all flirtations by comparison. Tucker Crowe was his life partner. If Crowe were to die in real life, as it were, rather than creatively, Duncan would lead the mourning. He'd already written the obituary. Every now and again he'd worry out loud about whether he should show it to a reputable newspaper now or wait until it was needed.
And that's Nick Hornby reading from his new novel, Juliet Naked. Why did you want to focus a novel around an artist who stopped recording and someone who's devoting much of his life to analyzing that musician's body of work and figuring out what elements are autobiographical, having a website devoted to this artist? And then also the girlfriend of the guy who's obsessive about the singer-songwriter. And the book rotates between the points of view of each of these three characters. Why did you want to focus around the artist who could no longer make art and the people who are obsessing on him?
Well, I think this book started with an article I read in a magazine 3 or 4 years ago about Sly Stone, in fact, who at the time was a recluse, and the journalist had managed to fix up an interview with him, and eventually he turned up for it. And there was such a sort of narrative thrill in that, somebody appearing after a long absence and a fan's excitement meeting this person. Something about it stuck in my mind, and there was also something about those guys' relationships with, you know, the Dylans and the Springsteens, the people who lecture on those people. And that idea of Annie meeting Tucker and possibly there being some kind of flirtation involved, I like the idea of what Duncan would think about that. I mean, half of those Dylan guys, if Dylan met their wives on the road, those guys would want their wives to sleep with Bob Dylan rather than not, if you see what I mean.
Because, it would make them more valuable.
More valuable, and also the information that you would get out of
somebody. True.
So there was something about that appealed to me too.
Children play a very interesting role in the book. You know, the couple in the book doesn't have children, and mm-hmm. and she's at the point where she's decided she really wants children and wondering if it's become too late for her. And at the same time, the musician, Tucker Crowe, he has children by women he barely remembers. He's having a grandchild through a daughter he's never met. But he's now raising a six-year-old who's the center of his life. And so for all the people in the novel, having a child or not having a child is nothing the way it once was. Like, there's a whole new calculus now.
Yes. Well, first of all, families are a lot more complicated, I think, for more or less everybody.
Absolutely.
Partly I wanted to dramatize that thing that probably all parents know, which is that you are not human if you don't spend a moment in your life fantasizing about having no children. And people without children, of course, spend parts of each day fantasizing about life with children. And there are these two parallel universes, and each looks equally attractive to the other.
Has having a son changed your relationship to music and books and movies? You probably have less time, but how has it changed your relationship to that?
Well, I have three sons.
You have three sons, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Now I've got my 16-year-old and I have two little ones, a 6 and a 5-year-old. The little ones in particular, yes, have changed my relationship with things. We are now devoted watchers of a program called X Factor, which I don't know if you have here, but is basically the same as American Idol. And I completely see the point of this program now in a way that I didn't a year or two ago. And it's interesting, things like that. They pick up on music. They listen to a lot of music. I watch movies with them. We go and see all the animated movies. In some ways, I'm less in touch with the things that used to mean a lot to me and more in touch with things that didn't. But I still have very much a relationship with contemporary popular culture through them.
So give us an example, I guess maybe you just did, of stuff that you're watching or listening to that would not have meant anything if you didn't have children.
Well, I was going to say as we speak, but not quite. But certainly the last 2 weeks have been completely dominated by a band called the Plain White Tees, who my little boys discovered through a program called iCarly, which I also didn't know about before. And it's not music that means an awful lot to me, but it's pretty unobjectionable, and it's not a million miles away from things that I like. So, you know, it's a common ground that we have.
Do you ever despair that your children like things that you think aren't good?
Actually, they do. They like pretty good things most of the time. But no, I don't despair about that at all. I think that I would despair if they didn't like things. And I think as I've got older, I've come to realize that the most important thing is that we have emotional connections to music or movies or books, and it doesn't matter what those things are.
May I ask, I know one of your sons is autistic. How old is
yeah.
he? How old is he?
He's 16.
Yeah, so has he developed an ear or an eye for music or film or books, the kinds of things that you're so passionate about?
Well, no, not books. He doesn't read. Movies he quite enjoys. When we take him to see a movie, he won't often stick it out all the way through. He's very honest in a way that adults and indeed other kids aren't. He'll reach a point and just stand up and walk, and you have to follow behind. He can't be persuaded to watch the rest of the movie if he's decided he's had enough. Music is an important part of his life. He just asks for music, and it's difficult to tell. He's quite severely autistic, so it's difficult to tell what he's responding to, and he doesn't ask for anything by name, but he needs it on journeys, and he has his own iPod and things like that.
Now, Annie dislikes the way that her boyfriend Duncan listens to music, because he writes about it. He considers himself a pop culture scholar, and she thinks that he uses his scholarship sometimes as to bully her. She says, listening to music was something that she did, frequently with great enjoyment, and Duncan somehow managed to spoil it, partly by making her feel that she was not good at it. Talk about that line, that feeling that somebody is making you feel like you're not good at listening to music.
Well, I agree with you that when you use the word scholar about Duncan, I kind of conceived him as a scholar. That if his obsession had been with, you know, Marla or Gerard Manley Hopkins, he would have been gainfully employed in a university somewhere. But because it's somebody that very few people have heard of, then, of course, he has to do another job. But I think scholars can be particular bullies, in fact. They're quite often the people who are telling you that you're reading something the wrong way, listening to something the wrong way. Of all people who are not so keen on a plurality of response, I would say it's the world expert in something.
In your new novel, Juliet Naked, you write a little about sexual relationships or about people wanting or not wanting sex. It's not explicit in any way. But I guess the point I'm getting to is that one of the characters in this, this singer-songwriter who hasn't recorded or performed in many years, he's in his late 50s. And sex for him is different. He's older. He's had a medical problem. I don't want to go into too much. But anyway, so you've had to deal with what a sexual relationship would mean for him at his stage in life, which is really different than the younger characters that you're famous for creating. And so I'm not sure what my question is exactly. But
how's my sex life? Now I'm getting
No, that's not the question. But the question yes. but the question is more about like writing characters. Writing about a character's sexual life and sexual desires or lack of desire, who is older?
Well, it would be very hard for me to write High Fidelity now, I think. I'm proud of the book, but it was a younger man's book. And I think turning 50 was quite a big thing for me. I think it was the first time I actually did realize that I was going to get old and die.
Did that change your life, that sense that you are going to get old and die?
Not as much as it not as much as it should have done, I don't think. But you know, when you turn 20 or 30 or 40, you go around making all the same jokes about, oh my God, I can't believe I'm so old. But when you're 50, you don't say it anymore because you just are old. So it's not so funny anymore. And there is a lot about mortality and regret, I think, in this book. Tucker's 6-year-old son has a real problem with the idea of mortality. And that was lifted out of my own 6-year-old and a stage he went through, which was pretty interesting and quite distressing, actually.
A fear that you would die because you're older than the other parents, that you would die before he was grown up.
I don't think he was too worried about that even. And I was 45, I guess, when he was born. So it was, you know, it wasn't like I broke the world record or anything. No, it was more him dying, everybody dying. It was just clocking that it was going to happen. And what I found hilarious in retrospect was how quickly I resorted to Orthodox religion as consolation. Even though I'm atheistic in my own beliefs. Then the moment he said, you're going to die, and Mum's going to die, and I'm going to die, and everybody's going to die. I said, yeah, but it's okay, because you'll see us all in heaven.
How do you feel about that, about telling him stuff that you don't believe in? Is it more like telling him about Santa Claus, or are you going to start actually telling him more about it and starting to believe it too?
I think as one gets older, one realizes the value of pragmatism with children. And obviously I'm telling him something I don't believe, but very soon he will be able to work out that belief for himself. And I think you cannot go around confronting children with the brutal truth at every stage of their lives. At the moment, my 6-year-old's convinced he'll play for Arsenal, which is our local football team. And he won't. He won't be good enough. But I don't really see the value of telling him that he's never going to play for Arsenal. He'll work it out for himself.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk to you again, Terry.
Nick Hornby speaking to Terry Gross last year. His new novel, Juliet Naked, is now out in paperback. Over the years, director Oliver Stone turned down several offers to make a sequel to his 1987 hit Wall Street. Its star, Michael Douglas, won an Oscar for his role as hostile takeover king Gordon Gekko. Then the economy plunged and the markets collapsed, and Stone decided it was a good time to revisit his old antihero. Michael Douglas is back in the new film Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Oliver Stone's Wall Street sequel, Money Never Sleeps, is a mixed bag. But unlike most sequels, it has a good reason for being. At the end of the 1987 melodrama, Michael Douglas's takeover titan Gordon Gekko was destined for prison, set up by his guilt-ridden protege, Charlie Sheen's Bud Fox. In the decades that followed Wall Street's release, Stone and Douglas were surprised they'd created not just a classic monster, but a role model. They shouldn't have been. Although Stone had essentially put leftist critiques of capitalism into the mouth of his capitalist villain as boasts, many would-be masters of the universe loved his easiness with avarice, his lack of shame. Bringing Gekko back makes sense. After 8 years in prison, which, by the way, far exceeds the terms served by his real-life models, Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky, what will Gekko make of a new breed of predator who makes a killing off bad mortgages and puts the world economy in peril? More important, has he changed? 7 years after getting out of prison, Gekko has partially rehabilitated himself by writing a book called Is Greed Good?, in which he questions the foundation of the current boom. He tells interviewers the core of the American economy is now finance, not production and services, which is no way to run an empire. But Gekko is off-screen for most of the first act, set in 2006, in which we meet Charlie Sheen's clean-cut successor, Jake, played by Shia LaBeouf, who's determined to make contact with the disgraced financier. For one thing, he's engaged to Gekko's estranged daughter, Winnie, played by Carey Mulligan. More than that, he's out for revenge. He worked for a venerable firm modeled on Lehman Brothers, and it collapsed, along with its chief partner, a Jewish care bear, played with incomparable gravity by Frank Langella. It was Josh Brolin's wicked Breton James, who works for a firm inspired by Goldman Sachs, who brought Langella's character down. And now Jake wants Breton's blood. And who could help him get it better than his future father-in-law, with whom he shares a subway ride?
What are you, some kind of energy freedom fighter?
No, Mr. Gekko, I'm in this game to make money like anybody else.
So what about money, Jake? You like her?
Do I like her? Yeah. I've never thought about money as a she.
Oh, she lies there in bed at night with you, looking at you, one eye open. Money never sleeps. She's jealous. And if you don't pay close attention, you wake up in the morning, she might be gone forever. And I think you want to be in the family business.
Which is what?
Payback. Except if I'm not in that business anymore, it's the one thing I learned in jail is that money is not the prime asset in life. Time is, and your time is just about up.
You know, there's fortunes to be made. Hundreds of millions of dollars betting against this bump. Just wish I had a million.
That's a juicy scene, and there are more leading up to the economic collapse of 2008. Stone brings his full bag of tricks to the film. Split screens, flash inserts of speeding subway trains to show that events are moving fast. It's laid on thick. In dark-toned boardrooms, the country's course is plotted by dark-suited men, with Brolin lit from below, pitching his voice somewhere between street thug and silky satanic overlord. In a wonderful scene, he sneers at Gekko, saying, "Nobody needs inside information anymore to get rich." That's what amuses Gekko, that all the plunder is out in the open. There might be a great movie buried in Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. Stone's pessimistic vision has weight. The problem is that the movie is so overloaded with characters and cross-currents and big ideas that it might have been better as a 13-hour cable miniseries instead of a 2-hour and 13-minute mess. The revenge plot falls by the wayside and then comes back ludicrously, and Stone spends way too much time with Winnie Gecko and her sad feelings, her disappointment with Jake for colluding with her dad. Carrie Mulligan is a gifted actress, but how could this simp be Gordon Gecko's daughter? When she and LaBeouf start hashing out their relationship, the movie comes to a dead stop. It has about 5 endings, the last so corny that it plays as if it were tacked on after bad test screenings. Douglas, though, is terrific. He brings new shades to Gecko, once a one-dimensional villain, but now torn in several different directions. He's outgrown the man who said greed is good. But the movie is so poorly shaped that his final moral contortions have no kick. Wall Street Money Never Sleeps suggests that Stone wants to go beyond melodrama to explore the way empires crumble from within. But this unwieldy movie crumbles under the weight of those laudable ambitions.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.